We squeeze it in. I am so sorry. We'll take the comment off the air. I have a couple of announcements to mention here. It is KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills Volume 3 special programming campaign. So I just want everybody to start thinking about it. There's a lot of fun and exciting things happening. The MLK remote is a beloved KBOO event. Got moved because of the ice storm. It is Saturday 1 to 5. That will be at Highland Church, but it will also be here on the radio, which we love to have. Also, of course, the Cascade Festival of International Films is going on the weekends through March. So the URL is africanfilmfestival.org. You have been listening to The Gap on KBOO Portland. I'm Althea Billings. Thank you so much to my interview guests from earlier. Thank you to everybody who called. Thank you to Tammy. Thank you to Sherry, who's running the board for me. And we will be back next week. Have a lovely day.
Jill Fritz with the Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during the special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series all brought to you by our talented programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a 2-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Hi, this is Melissa Lesniak, the creator and host of That Vegan Show. On That Vegan Show, you will hear in-depth guest interviews on vegan-related topics, such as companion animals, environmentalism, social issues, and food and nutrition. We also learn about specific animals, such as possums and rabbits, including their needs and ways to help them. Be sure to tune in to That Vegan Show on the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m., right here on KBOO Portland.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim.
Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show. I'm your co-host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. In the first half of the show, co-host Mickey Huff sits down with attorney Art Bellenduke and media activist and journalist Sue Wilson to talk about the poisoning of our airwaves with propaganda. Art and Sue outline a case in Baltimore that highlights how media corporation Sinclair is trying to control what we hear and see, and how the FCC is failing in its responsibility to regulate media giants to serve the public interest. In the second half of the show, I share quotes from a recent conversation with Yemen-based freelance journalist Ahmed Abdul Karim about what's happening in his home country, the reasoning behind it, how the people feel, and what the future might hold, particularly in terms of U.S. hegemony in the region. All this and more coming up now on Project Censored.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, skies, another guys, democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes on the bridges. And the
welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. FCC regulators play the shell game with broadcasters. what really happened in the Sinclair Tribune FCC investigation. That's the title of a new long-form dispatch at Project Censored, written by Sue Wilson. Sue Wilson is an Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist now working to hold the U.S. government and corporate media accountable for their corrosive effects on democracy. She's a writer, producer, director of the award-winning Public Interest Pictures documentary on the media, Broadcast Blues, and reveals the structural schisms in corporate media at Sue Wilson Reports. Wilson heads the Media Action Center, which forced Entercom to surrender its $13.5 million broadcast license for its 2007 killing of Jennifer Strange in an on-air contest. Wilson filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court case FCC versus Prometheus Radio, excerpts of which are included in her comments to the FCC Quadrennial Review. Sue Wilson, welcome to the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you, Mickey, for having me.
We are also joined by Arthur Belenduc, who started his legal career as an attorney with the Common Carrier Bureau of the Federal Communications Commission. Art has been in private practice for over 40 years. His practice is limited exclusively to communications law. And since 1988, Art has been a partner with his Washington, D.C. firm, Smithwick and Belenduc. Art Belenduc, welcome to the Project Censored Show today.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
It is an honor to have the both of you here. And we have, well, what turns out to be a complicated story, but it's certainly one that really goes kind of the core of what it means to be a democratic republic and the role that the free press plays in safeguarding us, safeguarding we the people. Sue Wilson, you begin your article by saying the air belongs to us, but they are trying to take it away. And in this case, who are they? We're wondering who they are. Well, this is the corporate media owners, right? So Sue Wilson, let's begin with you and talk about this issue of media ownership, FCC regulation, and how everything's not always what it seems in terms of how ownership rules are enforced and how the public can actually hold the owners of the leasers, right? The lessors of these airwaves, we can remind corporate media that these actually belong to the people and in the public interest. Sue Wilson, tell us about this really important case that you're working on.
Well, Mickey, first, you know, I want to kind of ask the listening public here just one really simple question. Does anybody think that the media is working for us? I can hear it now. Everybody's screaming, no, everybody knows it's not working for us. And it should be, okay? Now, let's face it. There's a lot of media that we can't control. We can't control Facebook. We can't control Exeter or whatever it's called. We don't really control newspapers. But there's this one little area of media that we actually do own. And it's broadcasting. And I understand that, you know, we're on the radio right now, so your listeners here are really getting that. But there's a lot of people thinking, well, broadcasting, that's really old fashioned. Yeah, but it's ours. And you might be driving an old car and the guy across the street might have a Lamborghini that's brand new. You can't worry about how to take care of his Lamborghini. You got to worry about taking care of your car. That's what we have. Broadcasting literally belongs to us because they broadcast. The very program we're on right now goes over the air on very small frequencies. And in order to have the right to broadcast on that air, these giant stations have to go and get a radio license. They're licensed just like we're licensed to drive a car at the DMV. And if we don't follow the rules of the road, we can lose our licenses. And just like that, if the big broadcasters don't follow the rules of the road, they can lose their licenses. Except that almost never happens, but we're trying to make that a little more accessible for we the people, okay? And then there's another concept about DMV as well. What if the DMV all of a sudden decided to limit the number of driver's licenses that we all could have? Meaning, because there's only so many frequencies in this air, so only so many people can get licensed to have a broadcast station, right? Think about if you went down to your local DMV and they said, well, I'm sorry, but I gave all the licenses to my buddies. There's nothing left for you. Well, guess what? That's kind of what the FCC is doing within the broadcast industry. And that's what this very long piece I wrote really gets into in great detail. It's a game that they've been playing, and especially with the broadcast network called Sinclair Broadcasting, letting them have way, way, way more broadcast stations than the law allows. And let's be clear, the law says these broadcasters, the frequencies belong to us, and that in order to have privilege of broadcasting, you have to serve the public. That's the law. The FCC hasn't done such a very good job of enforcing that. And in fact, they're really in the bed, especially with Sinclair, to make sure it doesn't happen.
So Sue Wilson, you know, that's an extraordinary claim, one backed by mountains of evidence historically. I mean, you've been involved in these issues around the FCC and the people's airwaves and corporations sort of using them in their interest, not the public interest. This is something that we, the people, have at our access. This is a part of our civic engagement. Art Bellendoek, might want to, you know, bring you in here just briefly to touch on one of the things that Sue said legally, that you're saying that these are our airwaves and that there are rules. And the reason I want to bring this up, and maybe Art can talk about this, and Sue, you certainly can. We did a piece last fall, and Art Bellendoek, I believe you're connected to this case. Steve Masick did a piece on the Fox News affiliate in Philadelphia and challenges to the broadcast license there. We're now talking to you about a challenge happening with Sinclair in Baltimore. The reason I want to bring this up is this is the legal means by which we the people have to safeguard and check that these companies are operating in the public interest. So this is not censorship. This is not the people are taking away broadcast licenses from a company because they don't like the news they're producing. There's actually technical legal issues involved where these companies are violating those rules. If you could talk a little bit to that, Art, and maybe Sue, you too. The reason I'm bringing that up is that we've received, you know, some criticism at Project Censored because folks said, oh, you just don't like Fox News. You're just trying to get them off the air. You just don't like Sinclair. You're just trying to censor the views that you don't like. You're not going after MSNBC or something else. Well, that's cable, right? Or you're not going after CBS for one of their reports. So come on in here, Art. Talk to our audience a little bit about this, about the legalese and about the fact that this is well within the right of we the people to challenge this. This is not a form of censorship.
Every citizen has a right to petition the government. And broadcasters, what they say is, well, we have a First Amendment right. And absolutely they do. But they also, because they are licensed, they also have a responsibility to serve the public interest. And the Supreme Court, in a very famous case, at least for broadcast attorneys, called Red Lion v. FCC, said that the rights of the listeners or the viewers is paramount to the rights of the broadcasters. So, yes, broadcasters do have a right to broadcast, but they have to do so in a way that serves their local community. And that's really what Sue is saying, right? There's this huge disconnect. We no longer have to serve the local community. We don't provide local news. We provide some sort of national news. In the case of Fox, we don't provide news at all. We just make it up as we go along. You know, so all that kind of stuff that we're addressing, every citizen, there's nothing that Fox or Sinclair or anyone else can do. You sit down, you want to write a letter to the FCC. The FCC also has rulemakings and dockets. It's so easy. It's one of the few things on the FCC website that actually works really well. You can go into a docketed proceeding. For example, they're doing net neutrality right now, and you can file your comments as a citizen. Doesn't have to be formal. You don't need a lawyer. Just say, hey, this is what I think. This is what I want. You have absolutely that right. And at least in theory, the FCC is supposed to listen to you.
Okay. So Sue Wilson, let's go back to you. And so what exactly is this case about in Baltimore around Sinclair and the FCC? Start unpacking this. It is a long piece. People can read it for free at projectcensored.org. But Sue Wilson, walk us into this and help us start understanding what's at stake here.
Well, several years ago, Sinclair Broadcasting wanted to merge with Tribune Media. It would have created a real giant monopoly over the local broadcast stations. And everybody thought it would sail through because that's normally what happens. But surprise, 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 the FCC's own Republican chair, Ajit Pai, called a hearing. Wait a minute, something doesn't smell right with this. And in fact, what they said is whether Sinclair was the real party in interest with the WGN, KDAF, and KIH applications. What they're talking about here, they're smelling the rat and understanding that, and Art can describe this better than I can, but what Sinclair has done is they have created what a lot of people call sidecar companies. I would call them front companies. And why don't I toss it to Art to describe this?
So what happens is through a series of agreements, the company like Sinclair can take over another company. It owns it pretty much lock, stock, and barrel. And the FCC has turned a blind eye to that. In the merger with Tribune, because it was so large, the FCC said, look, guys, you really do need to get rid of some of these television stations. And Sinclair said, sure, no problem. We've got these front companies that we can offload them. And that, even for the FCC, that was just too much, right? And so they set them for hearing to determine whether they had lied to the commission and whether these truly were front companies, which of course they were. Once that happened, Sinclair had no place to go. There was no way it was going to address that issue in open court. And it immediately dropped its attempt to acquire Tribune, which was a big win. But more importantly, those unresolved issues, the misrepresentation, lack of candor, those issues remained and still had to be resolved. And this is where Sue came in with the FOIA request. And maybe I'll turn it over to Sue and she can explain, and I'll pop in a little later.
Well, thanks, Art. And you know, we have to go back even to the judge. There was a judge that was going to hear that initial case that Ajit Pai had ordered. And she actually said that the behavior of a multiple station owner before the commission may be so fundamental to a licensee's operation that it's relevant to have qualifications to hold any station license. And she was specifically calling for, we have to have a hearing on this. And that hearing could come in the form of another petition to deny the renewal of stations. Now, I want to get into this FOIA thing. And at the end, I want to talk though about the case that has been languishing that Art has at the FCC for 3 years. That's the case that should bubble to the top and resolve all these issues. But let's find out what the FCC really did. All right. We filed this Freedom of Information Act request. It took more than 2 years of litigation to finally pry these documents out of the FCC's hands. All right. Now, the FCC.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
You're getting there, but I think you need to explain to your audience these issues, these misrepresentation issues were left hanging. What Sinclair did was it ran to the commission and said, you got to make these issues go away. And so they had this secret procedure, which no one was allowed to participate in. This is the government that serves us, right? All of this was secret. Sinclair produced some paper. And the FCC looked at it and said, boy, if we had only seen this in the first place, we wouldn't have even designated you for hearing. It was all just one big misunderstanding. But you guys got to be more careful. So pay us $48 million and go on your merry ways. And that's where Sue came in and said, no, no, we want to see these documents, right? And the commission said, no, 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 you don't get to see the documents. Surely you're kidding, right? And that's where we got into a 2-year litigation over the documents.
So I just wanted to remind everybody that I'm Mickey Huff, host here of the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I am speaking with Sue Wilson and Art Belenduk. We are talking about how FCC regulators play the shell game with broadcasters. We're looking at what really happened in the Sinclair Tribune FCC investigation, and we'll get more updates and more specifics from Sue Wilson and Art Belenduk after this brief musical break. Stay with us. No time stops. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the program, in this segment, we're talking about media ownership and FCC regulation of broadcasters over our airwaves for We the People. I'm joined by attorney Art Bellendook, as well as media activist Sue Wilson from Media Action Center. Sue Wilson is also director and the force behind the award-winning documentary Broadcast Blues, and also at Sue Wilson Reports. Sue Wilson recently wrote a piece for us at Project Censored, one of our long-form dispatches, about the Sinclair FCC issue. We are talking with Sue Wilson and attorney Art Bellendook right now. And just before the break, Art was clarifying one of the legal issues. And Sue, you were going to come in and talk to us a little bit more specifically about what was in these documents that, well, the FCC didn't think the public should see, but apparently that wasn't right. Sue Wilson, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
You know, doing my research for this piece, I discovered the dirty little secret. And the dirty little secret is that these regulators, and this is not the full commission, the five commissioners we so often hear about. These are the bureaucrats who have their job for 20, 30, 40 years at the FCC. And what happens is big broadcasters like the NAB start inviting them to their parties and their conventions, and the state conferences invite them. And pretty soon, the regulators are all partying with the regulated. And so it's very easy then for them to say, well, we're just going to go behind these closed doors because we're all buddies here. We're just going to settle this on our own. And who's ever going to know? One of the key pieces I found, too, is that it's gotten so bad. This dynamic has gotten so bad that the FCC now has different rules for different companies. As my friend Art Bellendook says all the time, they have one set of rules for Sinclair and a different set for everybody else. There's a lawyer named Steve Lovelady who wrote about this, saying they don't even have any rules written down. They just decide what rules they want to apply to you or you or you. And Sinclair apparently gets the big pass. But let's talk about what we learned from this 450 pages of documents that we got,
which are linked to the article. I just want to make sure that folks know that this is very meticulously sourced and linked. So if folks want to go and read the article at projectcensored.org and other places online, I am encouraging you to check that out because all the things that Sue and Art are talking about are linked there. Go ahead, Sue. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much for that. First of all, they wanted to examine Sinclair's finances. And what we learned behind closed doors that Sinclair is not providing what they call gap financials. And I'm going to ask Art if he would talk about that.
Okay, sure. More importantly, what happened was they had to come in and address the misrepresentation issue. That is that they're not in control. And so the FCC said, well, produce documents. Show us why you're not in control. And of course, the documents were just garbage. I mean, it was just stuff that they filled in. And it was some 450 pages. Now, in a little AM proceeding, they got, what, 16,000 or 19,000 pages of documents for a little AM station. Here's a company that has 100 television stations. They were happy with 450 pages. But here's what happened. You know, you would think they would ask for audited financials. Were they audited? No. Were they produced under generally accepted accounting principles, something that I have to do for my law firm or my business? No. They use something called broadcast cash flow. And broadcast cash flow is something you use to create estimates of what you think your business is going to do. But it's garbage in, garbage out. So they came up with this set of broadcast cash flow numbers. They provided some documents and some publicly available documents. And the commission said, well, that's fine. Well, how does that address the misrepresentation issue? How does that address the control issue over these other stations? What control do they have? Well, they set Cunningham, which is supposedly an independent company, they set the president's salary. Right? They set the budget for the television stations that Cunningham has. So to be clear, Cunningham cannot change a light bulb at a station without Sinclair's approval. That's nonsense. There's no indication that Cunningham in any way is independent. They have a long set of options that allow them to buy out Cunningham at any time. And even though they can't own Cunningham, they can assign their right to buy it out to someone else. So the first time that the nominal owner of Cunningham said, you know what, Sinclair, I disagree with you, they'll say, that's fine, you're fired, because really, you're fired is exactly what they're going to say, right? What this guy does, I don't know. I think he is paid a modest salary for signing documents that are put in front of him. And that's what Sue discovered. What she discovered was there was nothing there. There was no one behind the curtain. That's what she discovered.
I want to go back to these options for a minute, because this is very important. It was widely reported that in this Sinclair Tribune merger, and they were setting up a new front company called WGN-TV to purchase WGN Superstation, which everybody remembers. And it was widely reported that they would have an 8-year option to repurchase that station. They, meaning Sinclair, would have an 8-year option to repurchase that station from WGN-TV. But if you look at the fine print, and indeed Newsmax filed its own petition to deny these broadcast licenses, said it in their petition, that comes with 5 additional 8-year option periods. You add it all together, Sinclair has a half a century option to purchase these stations that they pretend they don't control.
And if the owner refuses to renew that option after 48 years, if he's still around, they can just fire him and find someone else. It's an option in perpetuity. And the commission said, yeah, nothing wrong here. Nothing to see.
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me most, there's one particular document that I really pored through. And 13 times, and remember, we're talking about the regulated, partying with the regulator, they put it in writing. Sinclair is telling the FCC, well, you always let us do this before. 13 different facts that they were responding to. Well, you let us do that before. You let us do this before. This has been a game that has been perpetrated and accelerated by the FCC itself.
And so because, Art, you have this petition, this is why they're being called back to the table again and again. I mean, again, this is basically Sinclair saying, like, we don't understand what's going on because they because they, the rules weren't being enforced. And now there's obviously a wrench thrown in the works.
Yeah, that petition covers that plus other indicia of control. I use Cunningham as a shorthand. They've got about a half dozen front companies. They use Cunningham as the biggest one. But we came in and we said, look, this indicia of control. And we said, look at what they're telling the Securities and Exchange Commission. They're telling the Securities and Exchange Commission that we're in control of these stations, at least financially. So at least one of the indicia of control that we control financially, that's there. They control financing, they control programming, they control personnel. Right. So all the indicia of control are there. We've put that to the FCC. We filed that in a petition, and it's been sitting there for 3 years. The renewal cycle is 8 years. So I don't expect to see a decision for at least another 5 years. I may not live that long. I've got a lot of gray hair.
Well, Art, I just want to pause for 1 minute on that point, Art. Not the gray hair that we have and all that other. All the other things we share. But I imagine we share a legal concern that how is it that these stations just basically get a pass? They just basically have a rubber stamp renewal period and they can go on for 8 years at a time. It wasn't always this way.
So in Baltimore, you're allowed to own one television station. In certain markets, you can own up to two. The rule's complicated. I won't go into it for your audience. Here's what they got. Sinclair is operating 3 stations. And if those are not owned and operated, then I don't know what I've spent the last 40 years doing. clearly under Sinclair's control within any interpretation of the FCC's rules.
So, Sue Wilson, you conclude the document by talking about Sinclair's CEO, David Smith. You talk about his interesting business associate, Stephen Fader. Basically, at the end, too, you're saying there's a time for a reckoning. So can you talk to us about where we are and a little bit more about the CEO of Sinclair, David Smith?
Oh, yeah. Well, David Smith, and he set up his buddy, a car dealer buddy, to run WGN. This is a guy who runs car lots. He never ran a broadcast station in his life. Somehow he is going to be operating this. But I think what's really important here is that at this point, the petition to deny that Art has in Baltimore is critically important to tear the Band-Aid off of this whole wound and clean it out. And I must add that, you know, David Smith just bought the Baltimore Sun. Now, remember, Sinclair is corporate headquarters are located where? In Baltimore. So now they have one newspaper plus three TV stations in Baltimore. Once upon a time, there were rules against that. You couldn't do that, but the FCC keeps changing their rules. So bottom line, it's time for us as we the people to start exercising our muscle power. It's time for us to start shouting at the FCC saying, look at that petition to deny. And it's even time for people like me to be teaching people like all of you listening how you can step up and file your own petitions to deny.
Now, I think that's important. Go ahead, Art Bellendug, please come in.
I just want to say one thing in defense of Fader. He's much more qualified than David Smith's mother, who used to run Cunningham and had no broadcast experience, and Anderson, who used to be a financial guy and also had no broadcast experience. Right? That's who they put up.
Which is an indicator that these are financial arrangements. There's no journalistic integrity or ethics or desire to inform the public or any of these things.
The law says one broadcast station can only reach 39% of audiences watching television. And the reason for that is to prevent propaganda from preventing our air from being poisoned. Okay? And instead, what's happening is the broadcasters are steamrolling with the FCC to just allow one great big broadcaster to propagandize the United States of America, poisoning our air. We got to fight against that.
And I'll definitely, and I'm following the metaphor. And Sinclair was the company that infamously had the top-down marching orders where everybody at all the stations read exactly the same thing about their concern for information control and their concern. And it's like, the irony is just, it's just oozing.
We're running commercials during the news. Oh. Not in breaks, but in other words, as news.
Yeah, like ads as news. We see that more and more. We've covered the issue of pink slime in the era of news deserts. This is even more problematic because you can have these basically kind of front companies setting up as news orgs in communities. We the people, as you always say, Sue, these are our airwaves. We're the ones that suffer, and we need to, well, we need to clean the air. We need to clear the air in a lot of ways. And I appreciate that analysis that you've had for us. And it's also important that even though we're talking about Sinclair right now, and we talked about Fox before, the state of the corporate media in the U.S. is in a remarkably bad place. It's not just that it's Sinclair and Fox. MSNBC and CNN promote their own kinds of propaganda and mis- and disinformation. But this program today and this segment is specifically looking at the ownership issues and FCC oversight and regulations. And so I don't want our listeners to lose sight of that, because it's really easy for people to say, well, Fox and Sinclair are low-hanging fruit, but you let all the other ones off. No, we don't let anybody off the hook at Project Censored. But this issue is very specific. It's legal. It involves federal regulating agency bodies that should be working for we the people. Sue Wilson and Art Bellendug are doing tireless, often thankless work, and often without pay, to expose this kind of corruption and to try to educate the American public as to how this works now versus how it could work or should have been working historically, meaning in the public interest. Art Bellendook, anything you want to share about people following your work or the case or any last words for you? And then we'll go to Sue Wilson. Art?
You're welcome to contact me. You can put out my email address. I think it's important if you're listening to this and you're think this is something you want to be involved in, then contact the FCC. In the Fox case, there were so many comments, they designated a docket, which makes it real easy. It's docket 23293. You can go in there and file your comments, and that's a really important way to be active and to let the regulators know that you're watching what they're doing. They can't be doing this stuff behind closed doors.
Very important. Sue, it was Art Bellendook. Attorney Sue Wilson, from you, final words and places where people can follow your work in this important case.
I just want to say to everybody out there, remember that if you turn on your radio or your local TV stations, that information, that belongs to you. You know, shout about what's wrong. Meet with your local broadcasters. If they won't go along with what seem to be reasonable demands, we have been very successful in the town of Sacramento in getting local broadcasters to do simple things like putting 5 minutes of political election news on in 60 days before an election. But it took 6 years for us to do that. But you can have impact locally, and also you can have impact with the FCC. What I'd encourage you to do, especially on this Sinclair case, contact the FCC and say, WTF, come on. Why aren't you hearing this?
So Sue Wilson, yeah, WTFCC for sure. Sue Wilson, Media Action Center, Art Bellendook, thank you both so much for joining us today about this very important issue. You can read this piece in all of its detail, projectcensor.org. FCC regulators play the shell game with broadcasters. What really happened in the Sinclair Tribune FCC investigation? Art Bellendook, Sue Wilson, we'll be contacting you again later on in the spring or summer and hopefully see some updates in this case. Art and Sue, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
You're listening to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your co-host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll continue our program after this brief musical break, so please stay with us. Welcome to Project Censored. I am your co-host this week, Eleanor Goldfield, and in this segment, I will be bringing you some updates and some context and information about what's going on in Yemen and the Red Sea. I recently had a conversation with freelance journalist based in Sana'a, whose work you can find at Mint Press News, Ahmed Abdul Karim. Unfortunately, because of some technical issues, I'm not able to air the actual interview with him. But I was able to pull some quotes from our conversation, so I will be sharing quotes from Ahmed Abdul Karim, and I will also be giving information about what's going on there that we also discussed in our conversation and that I've been able to research as well from those non-corporatized alternative media outlets that are not parroting United States propaganda and towing the line of the State Department. So I'd like to start off here with a quote from Yemeni Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Saleh Abtour that was given during an interview on January 21st. He said, quote, We followed the history of the U.S., which entered the Vietnam War and was defeated. It entered a war in Korea and was defeated. It entered Iraq and Afghanistan and was also defeated. It imposed a siege on Iran since the establishment of the Islamic Republic in 1979 and failed. We are betting on our people, history, and the future that the United States will fail in every battle it enters, end quote. You can feel however you'd like to about the Houthis and about the government of any Middle Eastern country, really, but you can't really argue with Habtour's understanding of history. And I wanted to start with this quote because I think it shows a very important perspective that people outside of the United States, a lot of them are very clear about the history of the United States, not just in terms of the failed attempts at winning ideological wars in places like Vietnam and Korea or Venezuela or Cuba, but also about the aims of the United States, and that the aims of the United States as an empire and its imperial war machine is not out for humanitarian aid. It is not out to better the lived experiences of people across the globe or at home, of course, because as I like to say, imperialism is a home game. And so I wanted to start with this quote because it's very important that we recognize that other people outside of the United States are wise to what the United States is about. And I say this because at Project Censored, one of the things that we do is media literacy and how it's so important to break down the propaganda that we are steeped in. And much like a fish is not going to realize that it's in water, we don't realize that we're steeped in this propaganda. But when you go outside of your own country, I could say this as a Swede as well, when you go outside of your own country, you are less likely to see the propaganda from your own country with the same eyes, with as strong of a facade. Now, of course, the propaganda of Sweden is far less strong than the propaganda of the United States. And most of us, having grown up in the United States, having been schooled here in our school system that perpetuates the myth of the United States as a benevolent superpower, have a really hard path and a difficult time accessing the information behind that propaganda screen, which is, of course, why Project Censored does a lot of the work that it does around media literacy to try and help us all continue this work of seeing past the propaganda. And of course, you know, my recent interview with journalist Alan McLeod outlined some of these ways that the U.S. propaganda machine tries to perpetuate this myth, not just about itself, but about its allies such as Israel. So again, I wanted to start with that to give that context about the understanding of the United States as an imperial force by others in the world, particularly those who have been on the receiving end of U.S. imperialist violence, which of course Yemen has. And as Ahmed Abdulkarim said in the interview that I did with him, when I asked him about the bombings in Yemen that have since started because the U.S. and the U.K. responded to the Yemeni operation of blocking Israeli or Israeli-backed or U.S. and U.K. ships in the Red Sea, he said, quote, "We are with the Palestinians in everything. What the U.S. and Israel are doing are war crimes, and they are responsible for a vast humanitarian crisis. What can we do? We can support with demonstrations, with the military operations in the Red Sea. There are many acts that we are doing in Yemen to support Palestinians. We understand. We have been bombed by Saudi Arabia with support from the United States since 9 years ago. We have the same bombing. And this is why we are doing what we are doing for the Palestinians." And for those who are not clear on what's been going on in the Red Sea vis-a-vis Yemen, the U.S. and the U.K. have been launching regular airstrikes in Yemen over the past few weeks in response to the Yemen government's attack on Israel-linked vessels in the Red Sea. And that has, quoting now from Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, a senior member of the Supreme Political Council of Yemen's ruling Ansar Allah movement, said last week, I'm recording this on February 1st, he said last week, We do not care about your raids, and we will not retreat from our position and our struggle for the sake of God and our support for the Palestinian cause. The American-British presence in the Red Sea comes to defend the Zionist entity, not to protect international maritime navigation, end quote. So, to give you some context, that is what's been happening in the Red Sea. Basically, the Yemeni government decided on this operation that would target Israeli-backed and Israeli-linked ships in the Bab al-Mandeb Strait. To quote Ahmed Abdul Karim on this issue, he wanted to make it very important. He said, quote, Yemeni Ministry of Defense has confirmed that all ships not related to Israel are not harmed. Yemen has confirmed that the Red Sea remains open to international maritime shipping. They have also reaffirmed that the strait is off limits to the Israeli regime until Israel ensures the unfettered delivery of essential aid to Gaza, end quote. He adds, quote, famine, genocide, and displacement of civilians in the Gaza Strip forced Sana'a to take bold and advanced moves targeting ships in the Red Sea and only targeting Israeli-linked ships, aimed at forcing Israel to allow medicine and food to the Gaza Strip, end quote. And Ahmed also wanted to point out something that is important with regards to American propaganda or U.S. news propaganda. He said, quote, the Yemeni operation in the Red Sea is being blamed on Iran, saying that the Houthis are for Iran or that our operation is harming international navigation in the strait as part of the Iran-centric geopolitical context and not in the context of the ongoing Israeli operation against Gaza. I say to the Americans and to the Western world, this is not normal. The U.S. and its partners have been allowed to get away with one of the most obvious and egregious violations of international law and collective murder, end quote. You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your co-host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We now continue our update on Yemen with quotes from Yemen-based freelance journalist Ahmed Abdul Karim. Ahmed wanted to make it very clear that so many Yemenis support their government on this issue and want to see this continue because the Yemenis stand with the Palestinians. And as Ahmed said, they see themselves in what's happening with the Palestinians because, of course, Yemen has had the Saudi regime bombing it and creating a terrible humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And so the Yemenis are well versed in what a U.S.-backed onslaught looks like and feels like. And so they stand in solidarity with the Palestinians because of that. So that is the context with regards to what's happening right now in Yemen. And as an update, again, I'm recording this on February 1st. So if there are updates after the 1st, this is why you're not hearing about them. Please forgive us for having to record things in advance. Yemen's armed forces announced an attack on a U.S. warship on January 31st in response to the several violent airstrikes launched against the country this month by Washington and the U.K. So again, basically, the rough timeline here is that Yemen targeted Israeli-backed and Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea. The U.S. and the U.K. then responded by bombing Yemen, which, again, Yemen has been bombed by U.S.-backed Saudi Arabian forces for the past decade, basically. So this is just a furtherance of the violent, violent onslaught on Yemen, a country that, as Ahmed pointed out, is one of the most economically divested countries in the world, because, of course, the U.S. has tried to hit them with economic sanctions and divestment in attempts to try to forcefully remove the Houthi government, which is clearly antagonistic towards the U.S. and its regional aims. And so the next step for the Yemenis was then to respond by, again, yesterday, January 31st, they announced an attack on a U.S. warship. So as Ahmed pointed out in our conversation, quote, the U.S. and the British have been bombing populated areas of Sana'a and areas that have been bombed for 7 years now. There's nothing new about these airstrikes. We're used to it, and it doesn't affect us or our decisions. I think that's another important quote, because the U.S. is speaking the language of violence. And to quote Chris Hedges here, when you speak the language of violence, don't be surprised when people respond in that same language.
which of course the Yemenis are now doing, but also people become used to it, as Ahmed pointed out. And so the idea that this would dissuade the Yemenis is actually ridiculous. And if we look historically, it does the opposite. Just like Habtour said about Vietnam, about Korea, people tend to bear down and feel even more enraged and adamant and determined when you speak to them in violence. And I think this is very clear here. And indeed, Yemeni army spokesman Yahya al-Sari said in a statement on January 31st about the attack on a U.S. warship, quote, "All U.S. and British warships in the Red and Arab Seas participating in the aggression against our country are within the target range of our forces and will be targeted within the right of legitimate defense of our country and in confirmation of the continued Yemeni position in support of Palestine," end quote. Sari added that he vowed to continue to, quote, "prevent Israeli-linked navigation or navigation towards the ports of occupied Palestine until the aggression against Gaza stops and the siege is lifted." And this was a point that Ahmed also pointed out, that the Yemenis, again, they are more adamant and determined than ever. The U.S. is not gaining anything here. And indeed, Ahmed pointed out, quote, "bombing in Yemen compromises both U.S. interests and its moral standing. The interests of the United States will be harmed, believe me, because of the bombing in the country. It will benefit the position of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula." And this is something that we've heard from other experts and analysts in the past. When you bomb countries, when you occupy countries, you lead to a rise in quote-unquote terrorist activity because more and more people feel desperate and build some kind of militant response to the occupation of their country or the bombing of their country or what have you. This is well documented from Iraq to Afghanistan, Syria, etc. And we can see this just with the creation of ISIS. Basically, the United States created ISIS by its military operations in the Middle East. And this is a bit of an auxiliary point, but it's a point worth noting that the United States does not know how to do diplomacy. It only knows how to do violence. And yet the more violence that the United States uses to try and assert its aims in the region, the less access it will have to those goals. So I'd like to zoom out a little bit here and also point out that Yemen is acting as a bit of a vanguard in terms of this decision to blockade Israel. I'm reading here from the Cradle Media. On January 24th, they released an article that's titled "Iraqi Resistance Joins Yemen in Imposing Naval Blockade Against Israel." And the article goes on to talk about how Iraq has announced that they will be blockading the Mediterranean Sea until the siege of Gaza is lifted. And indeed, the leader of, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, my Arabic is not good, the leader of the Sayyid al-Shuhada Brigades, a faction within the larger popular mobilization units in Iraq, stressed that these operations will continue until, quote, "the unjust siege in Gaza is lifted and the horrific Zionist massacres against its people are stopped," end quote. And this very much echoes what Yemeni Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Salah Habtour said during that January 21st interview, that the country would not back down despite the U.S.-led attacks, stressing that military action against Israel will continue until the mass murder of Palestinians in Gaza stops. So again, we see this kind of solidarity against Israel and the United States and the UK, and solidarity with Palestinians spreading. And the US, of course, has responded not just by bombing Yemen, but they have bombed Iraq as well because of this support for Yemen and the support for Palestinians. And I also find it really powerful that the demands are so clear-cut. I mean, it could be, I have not listened to these interviews in their entireties. It could very well be that these interviews then go on to talk about demands outside of Palestine, but that Palestine and the ongoing genocide in Gaza are forefront on these demands, both in terms of what Yemen is saying and now what Iraq is saying about their decisions to blockade Israel. I think that's very powerful, and it speaks to a growing solidarity in the region that I don't believe that the U.S. is prepared for. And it's just, as Ahmed pointed out, it's just trying to make it look like it's an Iran-backed thing so that we can go against Iran, that we can start war with Iran. And again, this is something that I spoke to journalist Alan McLeod about, this push, in particular, this neocon group in the United States, but really many entities within the United States government, to push for an all-out war with Iran. And actually, if folks are interested, I would highly recommend checking out Matthew Ho, who has been a guest on our show in the past. Matthew Ho has a Substack. It's called Matt's Thoughts on War and Peace. And he recently posted about a war with Iran. It's called When Logic and Proportion Have Fallen Sloppy Dead, What the First Week of War with Iran Could Look Like. And he published this on January 30th. And it's a very powerful and indeed distressing outline of what he sees as the best and worst case scenarios in terms of a war with Iran. And he would know, if folks don't recall, he was in the military, did several tours, worked for the State Department. It has to be made very clear that, first of all, the people in the region, as I started this segment by pointing out, many of the people in the region are very clear about what the U.S. wants, about the U.S.'s track record, about how the U.S. operates. And at the same time, they are also growing their solidarity, not just for support of the Palestinians, but it seems also with each other. Iran and Saudi Arabia signed a detente. So it's very important to recognize that the shift in the politics of that region are not shifting in the United States' favor. So in terms of U.S. imperialism and hegemony, it is moving away from that. And it really does not seem that any amount of bombing, any amount of violent attacks are going to shift that towards U.S. favor. And again, you just have to look at history to see that that's the case. And we also then have to look at our own propagandized media to understand that this push to try and connect Yemenis' actions to Iran, that if they're doing just what Iran told them and things like that, or that, you know, Hezbollah's at the border and Hamas is run by Iran. We have to be able to sift through these propagandized headlines and read between the lines and see what's really happening here and understand that, again, it seems that the demands are pretty, pretty clear. Stop the genocide in Gaza. And it's what we've been seeing in the streets, not just, of course, in the Arab world, but here in the United States and in Europe and South America, like all over the world, people are demanding an end to the genocide in Gaza. And the longer this continues, as Ahmed pointed out, the worse U.S. interests will be in the region and, of course, globally. So that's a bit of a rundown of what's going on in Yemen. Again, I'm sorry that I wasn't able to share the actual interview with Ahmed Abdul Karim, but you can check out some of his writing over at Mint Press News, and hopefully we will be able to have him on the show some other time to share his thoughts. And you can hear it in his own voice. So I will leave it there. And also, in case folks are interested about some of the sources for this segment, I got a lot of information from The Cradle Media. That's thecradle.co. They have a lot of important reporting from the Middle East and specifically on what's happening in Yemen. So check that out if you'd like to learn more about where I got some of the research for this segment. We want to smash, crash, blast, smash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Eleanor Goldfield, co-hosting with Mickey Huff. For this episode, I've also been your associate producer, and Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Project Censored Radio airs on roughly 50 stations across the U.S., from Maui to New York. And you can find all our previous archived programs by going to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram just before we get deplatformed. And be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your digital tethering devices podcast application. Please feel free to contact us, share your feedback, or learn more about our work at projectcensored.org, and see our new publishing imprint, The Censored Press, at censoredpress.org. To learn more about my work or to contact me specifically, please visit my website at artkillingapathy.com. You can also follow me on social media at Radical Eleanor. Last but not least, thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
democracy, politics, the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, confine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we live with our brothers and our sisters.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life, of your journey. Join us first and third Friday of the month from 11 to